is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Afternoon, friends. This is Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. My co-host Jim Lafferty is still traveling, but he'll be back. He told me this morning by email that he'll be back in just 3 weeks. Yay, I can't wait. It's been a very eventful week and few months for political news, to say the least. So I'm really happy to have the opportunity today to talk to this week's guests to help us figure out how to sort through the facts from the fiction. In our first half hour, I'll be joined by civil liberties attorney, author, and activist Heidi Boghossian to talk about political propaganda, Christian nationalism, Project 2025, and more. Then, in our second half hour, I'll interview senior politics editor at Rolling Stone, Andrew Perez, about the real-life impacts of Supreme Court corruption. So let's dive right in. With the Republican National Convention in full swing and the DNC scheduled for next month, it's the perfect time to remind ourselves to pause and think critically about the political messaging around us. Whether we get our news from the mainstream media, independent media, or from friends and foes, we need to be on high alert for propaganda, like lies, scare tactics, and attempts to exploit our fears and emotions to further someone else's agenda. Of course, propaganda is not new, and we humans have developed ways to protect ourselves from it. For instance, we have logic. And we also have that plain old trusting our gut, like when you get that feeling that something just doesn't sound quite right. Well, this election year, on a scale of 1 to 10, the propaganda risk is running around 11. And with artificial intelligence in the mix, we don't even know if we're arguing with a human or a bot. So how can we protect ourselves from being duped? And how can we shine a light to expose harmful lies when powerful forces don't want the truth told? And how do we stay committed and brave? Committed to the truth, even when there's a risk of being shunned or punished by society. Well, to help us think through all of these things, I'm so happy to be joined by Heidi Boghossian, activist, author, and attorney. Heidi co-hosts the radio show Law and Disorder, and full disclosure, I occasionally co-host that show with her. Heidi's also authored 3 books, including The Assault on Free Speech, Spying on Democracy, and I Have Nothing to Hide, and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. Her most recent article is called An Exorcism to Save America, which was just published in the Progressive Magazine's special Media Literacy Edition, which just came out for June and July. Take a look at it. Heidi Boghossian, a warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Maria, so glad to be back. I think it's been a decade.
It feels like it anyway. It's been too long.
Too long.
So in your article, An Exorcism to Save America, you focus on Christian nationalism and the propaganda techniques used by its followers. But tell us, what exactly is Christian nationalism? Is it a religion or a political group or a cult or something else?
Christian nationalism is an ideology. It combines elements of Christianity and nationalism, frequently characterized by the belief that the United States was founded as a Christian nation and should remain so. This ideology often emphasizes the supremacy of white Christian cultural and political values, and can be associated with the belief that white Christians should have a privileged position in society. Now, there are a few key components. There's historical revisionism. Advocates often assert that the United States was founded explicitly as a Christian nation and that its laws and institutions should therefore reflect Christian values. The perspective often involves, as you can imagine, a selective or revisionist interpretation of American history. It also believes in religious supremacy. Christianity should be the dominant cultural and political force in the country. But then there's ethnic and racial exclusivity. A focus on the preserving and dominance of white, often Anglo-Saxon cultural and political norms. And that can include, and largely does, opposition to immigration and multiculturalism. There's a strong emphasis on patriotic symbols, rhetoric, and policies, often linked with the idea of American exceptionalism and a divine mandate for the nation. And we've seen that playing out after former President Trump's shooting, with people calling him being saved by God and the anointed one. And finally, it encompasses political goals. Policies aligning with religious views. That includes restrictions on abortion, understandably, opposition to LGBTQ plus rights, and the promotion, as we're seeing, of prayer and religious symbols in public places.
And about how many people in the U.S. identify as Christian nationalists?
Well, you know, there are numerous polls and surveys. One says that nearly 3 in 10 Americans identify either as adherents or sympathizers. And perhaps not surprisingly, Republicans are 4 times more likely than Democrats to be followers. 45% of Americans in one poll say the U.S. should be a Christian nation. That was according to a Pew Research poll. Although a third of U.S. adults in that same poll say churches should be kept out of politics. So I think, you know, numbers are hard to gauge at this point, but we're certainly seeing in the news media a rise in coverage of this topic, and especially with Trump's running for president again, a lot more allusions to religious rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. And who are some of the more prominent individuals and groups that have come out as and identified as Christian nationalists?
Well, there are many. Some notable examples include Marjorie Taylor Greene, the U.S. representative known for her outspoken views. She's made statements that align with Christian nationalism ideas, and she's openly used that term to describe herself. Then there's the former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, who has also made public statements that resonate with Christian nationalist themes, including advocating for the U.S. to have, quote, one religion. Pennsylvania State Senator and gubernatorial candidate Doug Mastriano has also been associated with Christian national rhetoric and has emphasized the need for such values in our government. And then finally, Ray Moore, the former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court and U.S. Senate candidate, has been a vocal advocate for the integration of Christian principles into public life, including opposing the separation of church and state.
So Heidi Boghossian, in your article, you warn that Christian nationalism implicates, quote, a host of undemocratic ideals. Can you talk us through what you mean by that?
Well, in a general sense, Christian nationalism promotes ideals that can be seen as anti-democratic because of their exclusionary and authoritarian tendencies. But take Trump's Project 2025, spearheaded by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, this is a comprehensive plan that unabashedly intends to influence the next conservative administration in the U.S., especially if Trump or a similar candidate assumes office in 2024. The project has significant ties to white Christian nationalist ideals and promotes several exclusionary and undemocratic practices. It would undermine church-state separation by embedding Christian doctrines into government policies. This includes promoting biblical definitions of family and marriages, and advocating for policies that privilege Christian beliefs over other religions or secular viewpoints, in contradiction to our Constitution. There would be attacks on reproductive rights and related terms for all federal laws and regulations. Project 2025 wants to roll back protections for LGBTQ plus individuals and proposes policies allowing discrimination based on religious beliefs. That would include denying medical care to these patients. And it aims to eliminate federal support for anti-discrimination protections. Public education would be impacted. The project supports reducing federal involvement in education and redirecting funds to private, mostly religious schools. They would teach conservative Christian values, often at the expense of diversity, equity, and inclusion, which are key to our democracy. Finally, it's worth mentioning that there are concerns. Project 2025 supports measures that could suppress voting rights even more than they are now, especially among marginalized communities. That would include advocating for gerrymandering and restrictive voting laws that would disproportionately, as you know, affect people of color, low-income individuals, and other vulnerable groups.
And just for listeners who may not be familiar with Project 2025, can you just, in a nutshell, kind of explain what it is?
Well, this is a program that Trump has been touting leading up to this point. We've heard about it this last year in recent months. It lays out a roadmap for how his government would proceed. And I have to mention another important component that goes into Christian nationalism. They're big on patriarchy and gender roles, promoting traditional gender roles and advocating for a patriarchal society where men hold the primary authority. It's likely to promote xenophobic attitudes and policies such as more restrictive immigration laws and cultural assimilation requirements. I think that everything in this plan would really undermine our principles of equality and inclusivity and threaten the already threatened pillars of our democratic nation.
Well, that kind of segues into, you've alluded to some answers that are going to answer my next question, but maybe you can expand on it. What kinds of characteristics and buzzwords do Christian nationalists use when communicating on social media? How can we spot them when we're just going through, scrolling through our pages?
Well, if you're aware of some of these terms, which I will list, you'll gradually, I think, see them all over the place. But yes, I want to emphasize the internet has been fertile ground for the dissemination of these ideologies, often reaching out to people who may feel disenfranchised or looking for a strong leader. So the term Christian nation appears in many places, emphasizing the belief that the U.S. was founded and should remain a Christian nation. You may see biblical principles as a term, largely traditional values, family values, God's law, another term, and religious freedom. So we'll see terms that we've usually used to advocate for broader, more expansive freedoms for all individuals. This religious freedom is used to argue for the right to practice and promote Christian beliefs in the larger public sphere. So their freedom comes at the expense of other religious or secular views. cultural Marxism. I just saw this the other day. Patriot. And this is one of the big problems. Patriot and patriotism will be used, and it gets confusing, of course, in this case, to denote a form of nationalism very tied to Christian identity. But you'll see appropriation of traditional terms like freedom, as we mentioned, patriotism, God in country. So you have to, as a media reader, be considering the source of all writings, especially young people who may not know the difference in terms of sources and bias in media. War on Christianity, war on Christians. And this, too, goes to something that I think Donald Trump excels at. It's seeing themselves as victims because they see or fear that their religious identity may be under attack, that they are the minority, and they call themselves that. Spiritual warfare, you know, we saw that on the January 6th attacks of the U.S. Capitol. In images, symbols, costumes that some of the rioters wore. Restoring America. This is a call to return to a perceived past where Christian values were more dominant in American society. Then, and I just saw this yesterday, I work across from the New York Stock Exchange, and early in the morning, there were about six stands, pro-life, with, you know, disturbing images of fetuses with human heads tacked onto them. But that is a big one. Sovereignty, also big, used in the context of preserving national identity against globalization, but with often religious undertones. And then God's plan. We see that a lot. We see moral decay, describing what Christian nationalists see as a perceived decline in societal morals and values. Often they attribute that to secularism and liberalism, as you've seen. And then, of course, one nation under God, the phrase from the Pledge of Allegiance that emphasizes that belief America is a Christian nation. So these are some of the buzzwords often used to frame discussions and arguments in a way that resonates with others with similar beliefs. I think that savvy social media users will have seen these everywhere, and I just would reemphasize, consider the source and how they're really distorting words in favor of their perceived victimization.
Mm-hmm. Words and even images. I've heard people I know who are Christian and who accuse certain people of co-opting Jesus.
Yes. Yes.
The sign, American flag.
Mm-hmm. American flag. It's really a perversion of founding values of this country.
Mm-hmm. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to 90.7 FM KPFK. I'm Maria Hall, co-host of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm speaking with activist, author, and civil liberties attorney Heidi Boghossian, who cares whether or not you are duped by propaganda and wants you to have these critical thinking skills in mind as we go about this crazy election season. Heidi's latest article is in the Progressive magazine. It's called An Exorcism to Save America. And in your article, Heidi, you talk about media literacy interventions. Now, I had never heard of that phrase before, but I noticed that the Progressive magazine combined with Project Uncensored, is that right?
Project Censored.
Project Censored. To uncensor, yes. So please tell us about that so I'm not just rambling on about things I don't know about. Talk about what is a media literacy intervention and why are you calling for one in response to Christian nationalist propaganda?
Well, you're not alone, Maria. Very few people have heard of that term, and it's actually, it sounds more intricate than it is. A media literacy intervention is really an educational program or a campaign or a set of activities designed to improve individuals' abilities to critically analyze and evaluate media content. And we're hearing so much about this as people whose kids have grown up tapping on a keyboard from an early age realize some of the risks inherent in social media platforms and the spread of misinformation, disinformation, and hate speech, too, which is also growing on the internet, because people can be anonymous, and also it's easy to recruit vulnerable people in cyberspace. But the goal of these interventions is to really teach and enable people to become more discerning consumers of information, better able to recognize misinformation, bias, propaganda, and then to engage more thoughtfully with media in all its forms. Now, interventions are used widely, for example, in public health to promote healthy behaviors, share information, address cases, say, for example, of anorexia, unhealthy habits, and then to influence public attitudes and perceptions. They leverage various media channels to reach broad audiences, and they can be highly effective in addressing public health challenges. There are awareness campaigns using media to raise awareness on specific issues such as smoking cessation, vaccination, HIV prevention. In New York, we see this on all the subways, outdoor, on posters, and on TV ads. Then there's behavior change communication, designing messages that encourage individuals to adopt healthier behaviors like exercising regularly, having a balanced diet, safe sex practices. In my article, I was calling for a campaign to educate the public about the threat to democracy posed by Christian nationalism. And part of that is in the many educational forums that are cropping up all around the country to up awareness among especially young people and teenagers. I think that as part of these campaigns and educational courses, we have to include a component that deals with Christian nationalism, white supremacy, its kind of cousin, and other, you know, movements that are on the surface appearing, for example, patriotic and American, but that are really usurping our democracy.
And also, I mean, talk about the fact that you're not, or I think you and other advocates of free speech and media literacy are not saying, oh, we're going to tell you how to think. We're not going to tell you what to believe. You're just saying, can you explain that a little bit more? You're saying, hey, look behind what's being told to you.
Exactly. No one is saying that any American does not have the right to speak freely. Mm-hmm. We're saying, consider the source. Mm-hmm. That because we cannot trust everything that is spread on the internet and also elsewhere in media communication, you have to really be a savvy consumer. And that means looking for these sort of signal words and other things. For example, I just have to read something I just found mm-hmm. from New York Magazine. After Trump was shot, this has been turned into a fest of God protected Trump yesterday, House Speaker Mike Johnson said. Steve Bannon said Trump wears the armor of God. Now that gets in that whole war theme, the warrior, the armor. Franklin Graham, an evangelical minister, said to Fox News, God's hand of protection was on Trump. And more and more, he was blessed. So we are seeing in the public domain really a mainstreaming of Christian nationalism terms and ideas. And that's what we're advising everyone to be on the alert for.
Wow. And do you have any practical advice for people who fear a friend or loved one might be falling for propaganda or, you know, really might not be critical and taking certain what you've talked about, kind of going down a rabbit hole. How do we keep communication lines open? Do you have any practical advice for people on, you know, how do you talk to somebody who may not want to hear it?
Well, you have to practice patience, empathy, and understanding. Family members can believe by learning about the issue, get to know its beliefs, find some commonalities maybe with beliefs that that family member might have had 10 years ago. Stay informed, keep up to date with discussions so you can be well prepared to converse. Create a safe space so that the family member feels he or she is not going to be attacked or judged or confronted. And show genuine interest. Listen actively. That builds trust and can open the door for meaningful dialogue. Ask questions. Just a few more tips. Find common ground and promote positive influences. Highlight positive role models. And if necessary, consider seeking professional help, depending on the age of the person and how this is impacting their life. And model by positive behavior while staying patient and hopeful.
And this one is it might be tough, but you embody courage and you're always out there sticking to the truth, even if it's not popular. So can you give us some tips also on how we can all stay brave and committed to the truth, even if it starts getting really risky out there to criticize the government or the powerful or certain groups' ideology?
That's a really good question. What I do is, I used to be very outspoken, and I would, if I saw something I disagreed with in public, I would say something. But living in New York, I do not do that anymore. And I do have acquaintances and friends who have opposite political views. And so instead of engaging, because one is never going to change the views of another person, I found, unless something in their life happens that has an impact on them personally. But I try to do that finding of common ground. So for example, it's been hard, but I've found a couple of points, for example, that I agree with, you know, theoretically with some of my ideological opponents, or just have a different viewpoint. And so I focus on that. And I'll say, look, you know, I identify as such, but I share some of your, I share your fears, I share your concerns, and I'm worried about where we are as a nation. And, you know, I do agree with some of your points, but I don't think unless we can talk to one another, we're going to make any forward progress. It's hard. I think the main thing is safety first, because you never know how people are going to respond. Keep limits. If you do engage in a back and forth, you know, gracefully get out of it.
That is such good advice. So we are running out of time. I wanted to save, you know, a couple minutes just to talk about, you know, all of the great resources where people can find really great news sources. But I really appreciate your last answer, because it is, it's a work in progress. And I think law and journalism, it's all about, you know, trying to get to the truth and trying to deal with society in a way that's not violent. So I think that's what we're all hoping for anyway. So can you let us know, you know, where can people keep up on this topic, stay media literate, and learn more about you, of course, and your wonderful writings?
Thank you, Maria. I'll tell you who I turn to when I want to sort of stay current. And that's Andrew Seidel, who has written two excellent books on this topic. One was The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. That came out in 2021. And his other book is American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. And that's its own topic. But there are several groups that are working on this. Americans United for Separation of Church and State, AU.org is their website. They work to protect religious freedom and the separation of church and state. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org, is another one. But I just do a lot of online searching on the topic. There's so much being written about it right now. And then if people, and there are a lot of religious entities that are writing and calling this a problem. So I think a lot of people around the nation are concerned, and especially when members of the clergy come out, we know we have a problem. So I just do my own little research, and it's in the news all the time. So, but, you know, I must add that our Supreme Court is not helping, as people know, and they're very pro-Christian nationalism, the majority, unfortunately.
And they don't need those pesky voters to vote for them either. So
right.
That's the subject of our next segment. But in the meantime, yes. So thank you so much to our guest, activist, author, and civil liberties attorney, Heidi Boghossian, for being here with us today on the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Maria. Bye-bye.
Sure, bye. Well, we are going to pause for a very quick station ID break, and then we'll be back to talk more about shining a light on corruption.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Maria Hall. My co-host Jim Lafferty is out of town, but he'll be back on August 8th. Woohoo! We're all looking forward to that. Before the break, I was talking with civil liberties lawyer Heidi Boghossian about how to protect ourselves from propaganda this election season. Next, we turn to the subject of exposing political corruption. Just a heads up, to accommodate the schedule of my guest, who's covering the RNC right now, we recorded the interview a few hours ago. So let's go ahead and press play on that, D'Angelo. With only 110 days before the November election, it makes sense that much of the news is focused on candidates who are running for political office, and they are putting on a show. But let's not forget, there's a third branch of government whose powerful members aren't subject to the inconvenience of elections. These figures enjoy lifetime appointments, and they don't need the approval of voters. I'm talking, of course, about the 9 justices on the United States Supreme Court. Now, other judges in the U.S. have strict laws prohibiting them from deciding cases where they may have a conflict of interest. For example, they're not allowed to preside over a dispute where they might have bias for or against one of the parties, whether that be for financial reasons or simply a close friendship. They're also discouraged from accepting gifts. For example, California judges can't accept gifts from a single source that total more than $250 in a calendar year. But not so for the U.S. Supreme Court justices. While they were required to disclose gifts they received, it wasn't until November 2023 that they adopted a code of ethics for themselves, which critics say really has no teeth anyway, since it's just an advisory and not a mandatory code of ethics. And of course, no one other than themselves can enforce it. But at least it's a step in the right direction. And arguably, the only reason the court even went to the trouble of adopting any code of ethics at all was because of journalists like our next guest, who uncovered decades of corruption. Our guest is Andrew Perez, senior politics editor at Rolling Stone. He has spent a decade reporting on money and influence on politics and policy, with a focus on dark money. Andrew was previously a senior editor and reporter at The Lever, and he's also reported for the campaign finance watchdog MapLight. Andrew Perez, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about your recent Rolling Stone article, Clarence Thomas, a $267,000 RV, and why American healthcare sucks. And it's got the subtitle, The Scandal-Plagued Supreme Court Justice Got an RV from a Top Health Insurance Executive, Then He Protected the Industry. Andrew Perez, can you start us off with some of the backstory here? Just who is this individual who had $267,000 laying around to hand off to his buddy, who just happens to be a Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas, to buy a big fancy RV? Who is this guy and whose interests did he represent at the time?
Sure. So when Anthony Welters has been a longtime friend of Clarence Thomas, and when he gave him an RV loan, he was running, he was heading up a Medicaid HMO called AmeriChoice. In 2002, he sold this HMO to United Healthcare, and he then became, he went on to serve a long career at United Health through, I believe, 2016. And so he then ultimately joined the sort of upper echelons of the United Health executive ranks.
And this $267,000 was, I'm a little bit confused about whether it was a loan or was it a gift?
Yeah, well, maybe a little bit of both. So it was a loan given out in 1999. It's been under investigation by the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee because, it doesn't appear that it was paid back. In fact, Welters, the executive, ultimately forgave most or all of the loan. You know, it's clear that that Thomas was paying originally, the interest on it. Like there's proof that he was paying something like writing like $20,000 check 1 year, which would have been sort of consistent with what the would have been expected as an interest payment. After I believe 9 years, Welters wrote to Thomas saying that he was forgiving the rest of the loan, basically saying that he had paid enough off. But there's no indication that Thomas ever actually paid off the underlying principal on the loan. The RV was worth $267,000. Senate Democrats, some of them are contending, some of them are asking for a federal investigation into this by the U.S. Justice Department because, you know, the loan was forgiven and it was not reported to ethics officials as was required. They say this was taxable income and thus, you know, needed to be reported to ethics officials. But even more than that, it better have been reported to the IRS. So they're requesting that the Justice Department look into, you know, both of those issues.
Well, I do want to ask a little bit more about that one in a sec, about what's going on now, because I do understand that was sort of recent news. So let's stay back for a second, though, back in the day that Clarence Thomas got this. Was that 2002 or 2004?
Well, so it was 1999. And then in 2004, the loan was extended for I believe, another 10 years. And in 2008, it was forgiven.
I see. So now, to his credit, Justice Thomas did recuse himself from some of the cases involving Anthony Welters, I believe. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But what I understand from your article is that those recusals didn't really stop him from exerting influence that substantially benefited Welters and the entire healthcare industry. Can you talk a little bit about this, please?
Yeah, well, so Thomas withdrew from two cases involving United Health, where United Health was a named party to the case. We don't actually know why he recused. I would say the RV loan offers a pretty good potential reason for why he was recusing. It's not common for justices to withdraw or recuse themselves from cases. They generally do not say why they are recusing themselves in those cases, and Justice Thomas did not do so. In 2004, he authored the lead opinion in a case that was involving Aetna Health and Cigna, where they were sued by patients who said that the health insurers had wrongfully denied them certain health treatments, and they had suffered adverse harms as a result. And the Thomas opinion basically says that is fine, that these are employer-sponsored health insurers, and they and state laws that seek to regulate their behavior, seek to regulate how they handle claims and benefits, are preempted by ERISA, the 1974 law, which, you know, it was designed to effectively protect employee benefits, welfare benefits, you know, pensions, including health insurance. You know, the Supreme Court has basically, you know, including in this case, has preempted employer-sponsored health insurers from being has preempted state laws governing employer-sponsored health insurers, saying that they are not covered by them, including when, you know, their decisions have to do with medical treatment, when they are, you know, potentially harming their patients by denying them certain services and saying you can't even get this, right? Like, the Thomas opinion has been a real boon for the health insurance industry generally. You know, United Health has obviously a big big interest in that space. You know, half of Americans are on employer sponsored health insurance coverage one way or another. So it's something that has a really broad impact for patients in this country.
Right. Well, that was exactly my next question is, you know, zooming out for a minute, let's go macro cosmic economic theory. No, we'll keep it light. But when you talk about profits and losses in a capitalist economy, it's usually a zero sum game, right? The profits that the insurance company gets, that's not just growing on trees. It comes from somewhere. So someone else must be paying. So my question to you, of course, is which you started to allude to is, who's really paying for the who's taking on the burdens here if the insurance company gains?
Yeah, well, you know, I think like healthcare lawyers would say that that this has been, you know, bad for providers, for doctors, for hospitals, because it actually puts a lot it basically offloads liability onto them for medical treatment decisions that they're not even really making, because, you know, like as the lawyer for the plaintiffs, or sorry, for the patients argued at the Supreme Court, the health insurers are making treatment decisions, and they're saying you have to follow, you have to do this instead of that, and you know, by shielding them from liability, that liability actually gets pushed on to the doctors who, you know, might be prescribing a different course of action. In this case, they were, you know, in this case, they were saying, you know, this patient should take this medicine, and the insurance company is saying, what if they take these two medicines instead? What if they tried them first, two arthritis medicines first? And one of them caused internal bleeding for the patients, for the patient. In the other case, Cigna said, like after this patient had a hysterectomy, said that no, you cannot stay in the hospital several extra days as was recommended by the doctor. So, you know, and the patient then suffered complications, needed to go right back to the hospital. So, you know, at some level, the money, the risk, the burden is being passed on to the providers. But, you know, the other people who are dealing with the costs and the ramifications are the patients themselves, right? Like, if you're told to do XYZ and you have, like, by your insurance company, and you have an adverse health reaction, like, you're on the hook for whatever dealing with that is going to look like, unless you manage to get some money out of the provider for the decision that was not theirs. So, you know, I think this is also just one of, you know, a million ways in which our healthcare system, and the specifically our health insurance-based system and our employer health insurance-based system are designed to drive up system costs, right? And not give people good care. So, you know, ultimately, like, we are all paying some type of burden or bearing some type of burden or cost from, you know, decisions like this. Like, medical care is more expensive and worse, right? So, like, that's, we are all bearing the cost of it.
Ooh, yeah. And not to mention the fact that some medical providers that are actually really decent and have integrity and are really professional end up opting out of these plans.
Yeah.
So people who don't have money can't access
people. That is true. And one thing that that's really, really worth, like, we didn't really get into this into the piece, but honestly, like, the Supreme Court argument over this case where Scalia was really going off is like fascinating, because, you know, they basically argue like, what the patient should have done is just pay for it, right? Like, which, like, as the lawyer points out to us in this piece, like, his patients did not have the money to just pay for the services that are being recommended to them or the medicines that are being recommended to them. But, like, that's also not necessarily even an option, because the insurance companies at the time were, like, if, you know, if they recommended a course of action and the doctors don't actually go along with it, they could be penalized financially by the health insurer. So, like, it's not even as simple as, like, oh, if you want XYZ, pay for it. Because if you're in a HMO, if you're in a managed healthcare plan, they could actually penalize the doctor for not going along with their own plan. So it's not even as simple as paying for it. They really are forcing certain health treatment decisions or. So it's really an amazing case. And ultimately, Clarence Thomas, that is his argument, is that the patients should have just paid for it, or that they should have just paid for it, or sought some type of injunction, AKA sued to stop this, which is just, I don't know, does not sound realistic in any sense.
No. And speaking as an attorney, that would cost you thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars more, and you'll lose. So,
yes.
Yes. Wow. Okay. Well, let's zoom back in again, talking about this person, Anthony Welters. So, at least in my circles, I have to admit, I had not heard of him until I read your article. And, you know, not like the other people who you often write about, Leonard Leo and Harlan Crow, who I think are becoming more household names, thankfully, thanks to reporting like yours. So talk about Anthony Welters, about his career and what he's doing now.
Yeah, well, so he spent, you know, like 14 years at United Health, you know, basically working his way up from sort of like a business within, you know, sort of an independent business, I think, within United Health, to becoming a high level executive, like a senior advisor, and, you know, walked away with, at least as we understood it, like $35 million in United Health stock when he left, you know, potentially more, if we're being honest. But, you know, he then runs a consulting or some type of firm, couldn't really tell what it is, but with Cheryl Mills, who it's called the Black Ivy Group, running it with Cheryl Mills, who was a longtime Hillary Clinton advisor. And then I believe he's also at the Carlyle Group too. So he's, you know, he has moved on from this, you know, sector and is doing other work. You know, one thing I'll say is, like, you know, the thing about the RV loan never being disclosed was, like, that was up to Clarence Thomas to disclose it, right? Like, it's not necessarily his fault for any of this, Welters. Like, Thomas should have been disclosing this on his ethics forum, and he should have disclosed when the loan was forgiven that he was receiving, you know, some type of windfall as a result of that. So the onus, the burden there is really on Justice Thomas, and that's not, you know, that's not a function of the Supreme Court not having a binding ethics code and not really having any ethics code until the last year. you know, that is like, these are like sort of federal statutes that affect every, like, any judge, any justice, like they have to comply with some sort of baseline financial disclosure requirements. So, you know, the other thing is, it is my understanding that that, you know, we've seen some of the people who have been sort of swept up in this ethics scandal at the Supreme Court, you know, or the swirling ethics scandals at the Supreme Court. Some of them, you know, have really refused to comply. You know, chief among them, Leonard Leo, has refused to comply. He's refusing to the longtime conservative legal activist who really kind of helped assemble the Supreme Court's conservative supermajority as Donald Trump's legal advisor. He has, you know, refused to comply with requests for any subpoena requesting information about his gifts to the justices, or whether he had steered any, you know, payments to justices or their wives or their spouses. You know, there is reporting that he had steered consulting payments to Clarence Thomas's wife secretly. Some reporting by the Washington Post to that effect. You know, it sounds like, by all indications, Anthony Welters has complied with the Senate Democrats on the Judiciary's request for information about this loan. So, you know, he has been complying. I think that's some part of why he has not been dragged into, you know, or not sort of been, you know, in the news as much as the other sort of benefactors of Clarence Thomas.
Interesting. Okay. And for those just tuning in, you're listening to 90.7 FM. I'm Maria Hall, co-host of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm speaking with senior politics editor of Rolling Stone, Andrew Perez. All right. Well, Andrew, I understand that last week, you alluded to this, two U.S. senators asked for a criminal investigation of Clarence Thomas. What was it that sparked their interest in doing so now, and what are the violations they suspect Justice Thomas committed?
Well, so they are asking if he reported the RV loan being forgiven as taxable income, you know, as would be required. And then, you know, relatedly, I think if he was reporting it as taxable income, which he should have been, why wasn't it disclosed on ethics forms, which, you know, you're not allowed to lie on those ethics forms. You're not allowed to omit, you know, giant information like that. like, so there's potential ramifications with that disclosure as well. You know, they're also asking, you know, I think about sort of the repeated pattern of failure to comply with ethics disclosure laws, you know, with what we saw where, you know, he hadn't disclosed some two decades of luxury gifts, you know, in the form of private jet rides and super yacht, you know, visits and trips with Harlan Crow, the conservative Texas billionaire. You know, I think Crow has provided some information to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And as a result, you know, we've now seen some of the trips confirmed that had been reported originally by ProPublica. So, you know, that's one thing that they're looking at, or sorry, that's the second thing they're looking at. I also think they're then asking questions about whether he had received any gifts from Leonard Leo as well.
Ah, interesting. Okay, well, I don't know how we always, it always goes by so fast here, and we do have a couple of minutes. So I always like to end with something that's, you know, a little inspiring, because we do talk about some very heavy things here, and it's easy for people to just want to go and hide their heads under the covers. So I did want to ask you, I mean, you've been working in this field your whole career on exposing corruption, publicly exposing corruption, putting your name out there in lights. Not so much. You're not going out for attention, but you're also not shying away from putting your name out there, and including corruption by some of the most powerful people in the world. So can you talk about, you know, kind of, and also advice for people who may be thinking, wow, how can I get courage propaganda is crazy out there. How do we keep strong and keep committed to the truth when really powerful people don't want the truth told? So can you tell us, just spend these last couple minutes talking about that?
Sure. I have been working in journalism for, you know, about a decade now. And I've, you know, been covering money in politics and dark money. And, you know, part of that is it was a way to get into the industry where, like, I, you know, developed sort of a niche skill set. But, you know, the other thing is I have like so little interest in, you know, sort of like non-investigative news stories, right? Like, I think it's our job to shine a light on what powerful people are doing. Like, I think that's sort of the whole point of the enterprise. And, you know, when you look at something like the Supreme Court, it's and the people who are, you know, showering them with gifts, cash, you know, keeping them sort of trapped in this almost like corruption bubble, where they are also fed all kinds of, you know, or basically they're hanging out with people who have the same exact ideologies they have. So it's this sort of like perpetually reinforcing machine. You know, the Supreme Court has vast power over all of our lives, right? Like, I think, you know, we're seeing it with, you know, with the rollback of Roe v. Wade, with how, you know, basically half of states now have, you know, abortion bans on the books in the wake of the Dobbs decision. You know, like, we see that, you know, the Supreme Court can make it, you know, even more difficult to regulate guns, as if, like, you know, the Republican Party is already like pretty locked arm in arm with the gun industry. But, you know, the Supreme Court is putting the kibosh on, you know, pretty much any sort of regulation on, you know, whether it be just simple, you know, bans on concealed carry, like on handguns, concealed carry permits, or what we saw this, you know, past term with saying that, no, you can't even, you know, we can't even regulate bump stocks unless Congress were to pass new laws, you know, which basically banned, you know, technology from being used to turn semi-automatic rifles into automatic rifles. So, you know, that's something that could have a potentially deadly impact at any time. That's not even to get into the many ways with which they're making it impossible for the government to fight climate change. And you know, that is going to the court's decisions on environmental regulations are going to have a giant impact on Americans in this country, and really the future of, you know, habitability of this planet, and not just for us, but for everyone. And it's, you know, I think it is really important to cover, you know, how we got here, who is, you know, helping pave the way for this kind of, you know, these kinds of really, really monumental impact or monumental decisions that impact everyone.
Very well said. And yes, it's a light shiner and a bubble popper. and also, people think of journalism as the fourth estate, the fourth branch of government. If the United States Supreme Court doesn't have to, they're not out there trying to get votes, it's not part of that democratic process. So who do we have? We have journalists. We have the public. Well, finally, Andrew Perez, where can listeners read more about your work and kind of follow what you're doing and learn more?
Sure. You can find my work at rollingstone.com. And you can also find me on Twitter or X at Andrew Perez DC.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Once again, Andrew Perez, Senior Politics Editor for Rolling Stone. Always a pleasure to have you as a guest. Thank you for taking your time in this extremely busy election season.
What a season.
We will see you soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
before you're ripe.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind, and Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818